The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
The U.S. intelligence community has managed to penetrate and suck up a ton of communications. And what our sources were saying to us is, well, there's nothing basically in the tapes that we have of Russians saying, hey, great job with the pipeline, or wow, can you believe it with the pipeline, or oh, crap, what's going to happen now that we blew up the pipeline?
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 5th, 2023. It was a few months ago that something went boom under the sea and the Nord Stream 2 pipelines were severely damaged. Everyone assumed the perpetrator was the Russian Federation because, you know, the Russian Federation, war in Ukraine, really bad guys, and it was their pipeline, and the Germans relied on that pipeline for natural gas, and, you know, Vladimir Putin could deprive them of natural gas. But months have gone by, and evidence that Russia was behind the Nord Stream attacks has not surfaced. This was the subject of a lengthy article in the Washington Post, the lead author of which was Shane Harris. Shane, of course, is well known to Rational Security and Chatter listeners, a great friend of Lawfare. He joined me in the virtual jungle studio to discuss the article. What do we know about who is behind the Nord Stream attacks? What do we know about whether it was really the Russians? Could it have been the Ukrainians? Could it have been us? It's a whodunit. And it's the Lawfare Podcast, January 5th, Shane Harris on the Nord Stream 2 bombing. Okay, Shane, get us started with a bit of memory for those for whom the Ukraine war all kind of blurs together. Nord Stream 2 attack happened when? What was it? And why did people care?
So the attack on the Nord Stream network, and it actually damaged both the Nord Stream 1 and 2 pipelines. The Nord Stream 1 pipeline is older. This happened in late September, September 26th, and there was a series of explosions. The pipeline runs underwater in the Baltic Sea, and a series of explosions, we think over the course of about a 12-hour period, ended up rupturing both of the pipelines. And by rupture, what I mean is, you know, it like took a chunk out of them. There's been undersea footage of this that shows basically the pipeline is just kind of severed in some of these key places. And people may remember the very dramatic footage of these like big bubbles coming up, and it looked like the ocean was kind of boiling from underneath in the Baltic Sea in September 26th and into the 27th that were taken by Swedish Coast Guard and some other authorities. So if you saw that, you were seeing the gas kind of that was in the pipelines escaping and coming to the surface. So that was the explosion itself. That's now about, going on 3 months and change. And we can talk a little bit about the reaction to it initially, but safe to say, it seemed like most everyone initially thought Russia had blown up this pipeline. And many officials came out quickly and said that, and in some cases directly lobbed accusations at Russia. But basically the speculation was Russia had blown up these pipelines in an act of sabotage.
So before we get to the attribution question, let's talk about Nord Stream, because Nord Stream is a very important policy initiative that the U.S. has always opposed. And it's always been a complicated source of friction within the Western, among the Western powers, particularly between the United States and Germany. So what are these two pipelines and what did they represent?
Well, these are natural gas pipelines, and they carry natural gas from Russia to Germany to then serve customers in Europe. And you're right that these were very controversial, precisely for the reason that they, in the eyes of critics, and I think objectively this is true, would really yoke Europe to Russia as a major source of natural gas for decades to come. When the Nord Stream 1 pipeline opened, more than 10 years ago, the expectation was that this would serve European natural gas needs for possibly 50 years. The United States and a number of other countries opposed that because they did not want Europe to be tethered to Russia as a source of critical energy. Russia, of course, loved this because they had a market to sell into. And there was always a geopolitical as well as a commercial aspect to Nord Stream. And it was a diplomatic controversy, a political one as well. But when these pipelines opened, I think what they signified was, you know, to people in Europe, a source of energy, but to many of the governments in Europe, a strengthening of Russia as a state that could use energy as a form of leverage.
And Nord Stream 2, if memory serves, never quite opened, right? Because it was getting ready to open when the Ukraine war happened. The Trump administration had been very opposed to it. And then Germany had never kind of allowed it to go online yet. And then when the war started, it effectively put the kibosh on it. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. In fact, listeners may remember there was this very dramatic moment, within days of the war beginning when Russia invaded, where Germany announced that it was not going to give a final authorization to the Nord Stream pipeline, effectively saying, while this thing has been built, we're not going to authorize it to be turned on and finalized. And the reason that was so dramatic was because up until that point, you know, the Germans had been publicly doubting whether Russia was even going to invade. We've done a lot of reporting on this at the Post that, you know, privately they were very skeptical of U.S. intelligence. They didn't think Putin would go through with it. So when Germany came out and said, we are going to basically turn off Nord Stream 2, it was a real signal that the Germans had calculated that they were going to, you know, stand with the Americans and with the NATO alliance, and was seen as a real surprise, frankly, that Germany had taken such a dramatic step.
So most countries do not blow up their own pipelines. And yet when the Nord Stream attacks happened, there was, as you describe, a pretty widespread sense that Russia was likely behind it. What was the geopolitical and intelligence argument that led people to that very instinctive conclusion?
The geopolitical argument was, I'd say probably it was, there were a couple of major thrusts to it. One was that Russia had been attacking civilian infrastructure, including energy infrastructure in Ukraine. And so there was a precedent for the Russian military going after these targets that bring energy and vital support and services to, you know, large numbers of civilians. There was also a kind of theory of the case that it would make sense that Russia would attack the pipeline if what it was trying to do was shake the NATO alliance to say, we are basically willing to attack infrastructure ahead of of the winter in Europe, and basically, you know, blackmail these countries into either conceding to Russia or withdrawing their support financial and military support for Ukraine. In fact, the word blackmail was tossed about by a number of officials who essentially said that the Kremlin was going to try and strangle the flow of energy across Europe as a way of pressuring countries into withdrawing their support for Ukraine. And I think there was a sense that, you know, the Germans would react most, how shall I put it, that they might be the most swayed by such a brazen act of sabotage, and maybe some sense that maybe the Germans were never really even fully on board with the plan with NATO, and maybe this was a weak spot that the Russians could exploit. The intelligence argument for this, there really wasn't much of one. And this is what is very curious. There is really not any forensic evidence still, according to the many sources that we talked to in recent weeks, that conclusively attributes this attack to anyone. So you did not have, you know, spotting of a Russian submarine, for instance, in the vicinity of the pipelines. You don't have, you know, explosive residue that's been recovered from the explosion from the sites, although there is residue, that somehow definitively points to this is a material that is used by the Russian military. You don't have signals intelligence, intercepted communications.
That's actually the most surprising.
Yeah, that's that we found right? that surprising too. There's no chatter of the Russians talking about this that we could find.
Usually we think of the forensic evidence of the site as the key to these things. But I remember, you know, in 9/11, the attribution was all about signals intelligence right. in the first instance, and because it comes in much faster. And I think it's pretty surprising that you would have a successful major covert operation like this to destroy a pipeline and no internal chatter about it.
Yeah, that struck many of our sources were surprised by that as well. And we should kind of underscore this by saying that, you know, the United States and its allies have done an exceptional job of intercepting Russian communications, both spoken and written. It is one of the reasons why the United States was able to accurately forecast a Russian invasion of Ukraine. You know, I think it's not an overstatement to say that Russian operational security has been very weak, and the U.S. intelligence community has managed to penetrate and suck up a ton of communications. And what our sources were saying to us is, well, there's nothing basically in the tapes that we have of Russians saying, hey, great job with the pipeline, or wow, can you believe it, but with the pipeline, or oh, crap, what's going to happen now that we blew up the pipeline? All those reflections that you would expect to see and to hear, our sources are saying they don't have evidence of that.
So I don't usually say this to journalists, but talk a minute about your sources, because you actually flaunt in the story the diversity and number of them. I think you cite 23 diplomatic and intelligence sources. That's as somebody who's kind of a student of the art of sourcing, that's a flex. You're saying something there. Tell us about the universe of people that you've been talking to.
Yeah, so you're right. It's and we did that to say, you know, these 23 diplomatic and intelligence officials in 9 countries, because we wanted our readers to understand that this is not sort of chatter and speculation coming out of some isolated corner or small pocket of the alliance. This is a view that is held by a significant number of people across a range of countries. And we wanted to underscore that as a way of saying, like, look, this is, you know, it's kind of close to a consensus position at this point, as best we can tell. You know, we do identify on the record some people we talk to, including, you know, people at the foreign minister level. But we're talking here in this story generally about senior officials who have access either to intelligence that bears on the Nord Stream attack and the question of attribution, as well as people who have been briefed on it. These are not people who are, you know, catching things kind of secondhand at the water cooler. I mean, these are folks who actually are in a position to have some real knowledge on the subject. And we were, you know, really careful about not quoting people who were or talking to people who were just kind of getting idle chit chat, but people who actually had been looking at the problem, and in some cases working directly on the question of attribution.
All right. So one thing your story is vague on, and I take it it's deliberately vague because the sources disagree, but correct me if I'm wrong about that, is whether there is no conclusive evidence that Russia was behind it, or whether people doubt that Russia was behind it. Those seem to me different. On the one hand, you can say, well, the geostrategic logic of Russia's involvement remains strong, but they've covered their tracks well. I don't see any evidence of it. The other is, actually, there's evidence that they weren't involved or that this was not a Russian operation. Is there consensus on this point as well? Or from your point of view, is the only point of common ground that we can't say for sure that Russia did it?
I think it's more the latter, because there were some officials we spoke with who said that they still think that Russia is most likely the culprit for a number of various reasons that go to motive and to capability. And of course, even those people would say, but we don't have any conclusive evidence to point to that. There were some officials that we talked to, however, who said that they doubted the Kremlin was responsible. And we can talk about some of the reasons why if you want. But basically, they said, look, you know, it doesn't make a lot of sense for the Russians to have done this when it effectively, what it did was eliminated a considerable piece of leverage that they actually had. You know, it's notable that a month before the explosions, the Russians actually turned off Nord Stream 1. They claimed because of mechanical issues. I think everyone basically recognized that it was in response to the G7 preparing to put in place energy price caps. So the Russians had only a month before the attack actually used Nord Stream 1 as a tool for geopolitical leverage. And then a month later, the pipeline is blown up. That struck a lot of people as not making a lot of sense. So, you know, but I don't want to say that there is also some kind of conclusive file sitting around about who people think the culprit really is. You know, obviously people will speculate on who it could be in other countries that might have a motive to do it, but there's no conclusive evidence pointing to Russia or to any other country that we could determine.
All right, well, let's surface the elephant in the Baltic Sea, which is Ukraine. There is one other country that would obviously have motive to do it, and it's the Ukrainians. They're not known for their nautical prowess, but your story says basically this operation wasn't that difficult. It's not that deep, and there are a lot of countries that could have actually pulled it off. Ukraine has been pretty aggressive about fingering Russia in connection with it. Volodymyr Zelensky has talked about it explicitly. On the other hand, at some level, it makes more sense for the operation to have been Ukrainian than for it to have been Russian, in the sense that this was a mechanism by which Russia sells gas to Western Europe, not a mechanism by which Ukraine sells gas to Western Europe. And so you have a bunch of people scratching their heads about the leverage that Russia would be giving up by blowing up its own pipeline. It's not much of a secret what the Ukrainian advantage would be in having done it. Is there any reason to particularly suspect Ukraine, or is there simply no evidence as to who done it?
I think it's more accurate to say there's no evidence who done it. You know, there are those who believe that there is a strong case to make for why Russia would not have done it. You know, I think that, you know, we could come up with any number of kind of hypotheses or arguments for why different countries, including Ukraine, might have an interest in blowing up the pipeline. At this point, though, from the people that we talk to, there just isn't anything that points the finger directly at one country, which is another reason why this is such a puzzle. Like, you would expect, you know, if the Russians had done it, you would expect you would have signals intercepts or something like that. You know, you would maybe speculate that if the Ukrainians had done it, there would be some kind of, you know, telltale signature that had been left behind. But we're just not seeing any evidence of that yet. You know, the theory, I suppose, of the case of Ukraine did it, we could, you know, flesh that out a little bit if you want, would be, you know, is it a way of kind of bolstering the alliance and holding them together? I mean, do they want people to think that Russia is willing to blackmail Europe by withholding energy, and therefore does that strengthen the alliance? Possibly. You know, it is worth pointing out again that neither of these pipelines was delivering any natural gas. So, you know, I don't want to say blowing them up is without consequence. This did a tremendous amount of damage, and those pipelines would have to be repaired at significant cost.
And ecological damage.
And ecological damage, potentially, yes. This could have been a record. This may end up being a record-setting, you know, release of methane into the atmosphere.
And methane, for those who are not climate scientists, which I'm not either, methane is, you know, hundreds of times more potent as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide.
Yeah, and I think this is another thing to emphasize too, is that, you know, whoever did this, I mean, it's effectively, I suppose you could call it an act of war, but it's an ecological nightmare. I mean, it's a really reckless thing to do, to just blow up this pipeline, which I think is another reason why people initially suspected Russia, because Russia has been doing all kinds of reckless things throughout the war. So it seemed to fit that MO, if you like. But as bad as the ecological consequences of it could be, it's not as though destroying these two pipelines, or at least disrupting the flow of this gas, put Europe in a tougher spot than it already was. And in fact, European countries were already stockpiling natural gas ahead of the winter, believing that they couldn't, you know, easily depend on Russian sources as they had in the past. So again, I don't want to say it's without consequence, but there's an argument, I suppose, for, you know, hitting a pipeline that is not delivering any gas as opposed to blowing up one that is, if what you're trying to do is minimize the disruptions to civilian life.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey, Lawfare listeners. Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers, with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code lawfare20. So there's one other reason to suspect Ukrainian involvement, which I will float just in the interest of completeness, which is that, you know, around, and I'm not sure of the dates here, but around the same time as the Nord Stream attacks are the killing of Dugina, the daughter of Alexandra Dugin, the ultra-nationalist Russian ideologue, which was originally something of a mystery and turns out likely to have been a Ukrainian operation aimed at her father. And so part of me says, well, this is a period of time in which the Ukrainians are flexing and, you know, doing other operations that are kind of edgy. You know, maybe they take this risk as well. Is there any sentiment among the people that you've been talking to that there's a kind of, you know, this is right in the period in which the Dugin operation happens as well?
Well, you're right that those events happen near each other. Let me put it this way. I mean, we're reporting in this story what these officials said about the attribution and the question of whether Russia was behind it. That is all we're reporting. I think it has been widely reported that Ukraine is likely involved in a number of different special operations, some covert in nature, that are targeting Russia. I mean, the Dugina killing is one. There have been other unexplained, unattributed explosions and attacks inside Russia, including recently at a strategic airbase in Russia. So it's not as though it's a secret that Ukrainian special forces and special operations are active and are targeting Russia.
Right. Although I think there's a difference between targeting Russian military infrastructure, you know, that is clearly lawful targets in an armed conflict, and targeting, if they did, the daughter of a civilian, which I suspect is not what happened. I suspect that they were targeting her father, but and that's different still from targeting civilian gas delivery infrastructure in the exclusive economic zone of a European country not party to the war, i.e. Sweden or Denmark, depending on which part of the operation, which part of the... I mean, that would be an extremely reckless thing for either Russia or Ukraine to have done. And I actually find it hard to believe that the Ukrainians, who have been so careful and intelligent about the way they have played their relations with the West, would have been so stupid as to do such a thing.
I mean, it would be an incredibly reckless thing to do. I think you're right. And we should say, this is another point where it just bears repeating what we said earlier, that, you know, there are officials who still believe that Russia is the most likely suspect because they have been in the business of doing these reckless things. I think that the fact that this explosion cannot be positively attributed to anyone is what has led to, you know, not only kind of like speculation about the question of who done it. And after we ran this story, I mean, you know, it was very entertaining to sort of read all the different theories on Twitter in response to the reporting, including, you know, well, the United States must have blown it up because...
I'm coming to that one.
Okay, we'll get there. But yeah, well, let's go ahead and go there then if you want. But yeah, it would be whoever did this did something rather extraordinary, the political consequences of which, if they were discovered, I would think would be pretty massive.
Yeah, so partly just because, you know, U.S. covert action is a thing, and if we don't talk about it, we'll be accused of not talking about the elephant in the room.
Right.
So let's talk about it. U.S. definitely has the capability to do this. It is not normally the practice of the U.S. to conduct aggressive kinetic actions on the territory of allied states. That said, this is in the exclusive economic zone in the waters. It hurts Russia, but it can also be blamed on Russia. So it's kind of beautiful that way. It helps Ukraine, and it puts Germany in the position of, you know, sort of forcing it to break this relationship with in the kind of Ostpolitik relationships that Nord Stream always represented. So why is it crazy to think that this could have been a U.S. operation?
I think if I'm making the case for, and to be clear, I'm not making the case one way or the other, but if we're playing the, you know.
No, we're just asking questions here.
Just ask, people are saying, Ben. I think, okay, so here's the case for why it's crazy. One, the United States is blowing up a pipeline, releasing huge amounts of gas into the atmosphere, you know, a pipeline that is, you know, operated by one of our close allies. I mean, covert action by design obviously is meant to obscure the involvement of the United States, to provide a plausible deniability cover, and to affect certain economic and political outcomes.
No one's tagged us with it yet.
Well, right. Nobody. And so they would check all the boxes in that sense. At the same time, I mean, you know the U.S. intelligence community very well as well. I just have a really hard time believing that Joe Biden would authorize an operation to blow up two pipelines. As much as the two U.S. administrations have opposed their construction, it just seems like something that is so extraordinary and so potentially escalatory that I can't see this particular administration, at least, doing it, considering that it has been so conservative, you know, small c conservative in the actions that it's taken so far. Now, that is not to say that U.S. equipment or even training currently or in the past that has been provided to Ukraine, that Ukraine couldn't then take that equipment and training up and go off and do something, you know, on its own to the pipelines, possible, with or without U.S. knowledge or support. But the U.S. actually going out, blowing up the pipeline deliberately on its own just strikes me as, you know, color me skeptical on it is what I'll say.
Yeah, here's another reason to be skeptical of U.S. involvement. So I'm going to make a couple assumptions about your sourcing here that I'm not going to ask you to confirm. But let's just say if you're talking to 23 intelligence or diplomatic sources from 9 countries, it's exceedingly unlikely that one of those countries is not the United States. And I don't think U.S. intelligence officials would be publicly ruminating about how they haven't found any evidence that this was a Russian operation if the result of that rumination would be to focus more scrutiny on the United States when in fact it had been a U.S. operation.
Those are all good points.
All right. So in our whodunit, are there any other real suspects? If we say like presumably it wasn't the Germans, The Danes and the Swedes, most unlikely. Is there any other country with significant interests? I mean, it doesn't seem like a UK kind of thing. Is there any other plausible suspect?
Well, there's that vicious Italian Navy. No, I'm kidding. You know,
yeah, and you know, Turkey wants to prevent Finnish and Swedish NATO accession. I'm not sure how this does it.
You know, I think this gets us back. This almost it does kind of like feel like a game of Clue at times. Look, I mean, the two countries with the most obvious motive for doing this are Russia and Ukraine. That is not to say that other countries, as we've been discussing here, might not have motives of their own. You know, so do I think it's like a limitless universe of suspects? No, not really. You know, somebody did it. It's also pretty clear to the experts we talked to that it was a state actor. This isn't, you know, somebody who made a homemade bomb and, you know, went out on a fishing boat and just dropped it over a pipeline. In fact, we cite one German official on background as saying the explosives were affixed to the outside of the pipeline. So someone went down there, whether with a diver or a submersible, and stuck a bomb on the outside of these pipelines.
And I think you said it was 70 meters deep.
Roughly about 70 to 80. There's some variation, but that's about, you know, kind of roughly the depth that you're talking about. So, you know, theoretically, a diver could have gone down and done this, or a submersible drone. And these were, you know, scenarios that were floated to us, no pun intended, by people who've been studying it, saying like, look, it could have played out this way. But it's a fairly narrow universe. In any kind of investigation like this, people are going to look for who had the motive, the capability, and the opportunity. And that kind of key question of motive really is what keeps coming up and what does keep, you know, leading some people back to Russia. But there are, as we've been saying, there are those who say, yes, but the Russians had no real interest in destroying this pipeline. I will also note, by the way, that after our story ran, the New York Times had a very interesting report of its own on the Nord Stream investigation, in which they reported
about repairs.
Yeah, that Russia has been quietly scoping out how much it would cost to repair the pipeline. It would probably take about $500 million, the Times reported. Why would a country that had just blown up a pipe, why would a country be looking to repair a pipeline, you know, if it had blown it up? Is the question there. So again, not dispositive, but you can kind of put that in the column of whodunits. Maybe that goes in the column of not Russia.
All right. Is there a mode by which we figure this out? Or is this going to go into the category of dunno? As people contemplate this and tell you that they don't have evidence, are they waiting on some evidence or are they just stumped?
When it comes to the forensic evidence, which is to say, you know, explosive residue and debris and things that are found like at the scene, I don't think that's going to be conclusive. I mean, nobody that we spoke to said, you know, well, we're running more tests, or, well, there's just this one more thing that we're trying to scrape off the pipeline or we're looking for on the ocean floor that will tell us. I mean, I think that they've basically exhausted the investigation when it comes to the physical evidence that's there. And as we said at the top of the podcast, you know, there's just not any SIGINT that they're seeing in this. Now, could there be a very small universe of people in whatever country that know about this? And then eventually some of them do talk and that gets intercepted? Yes. Could someone slip up and reveal it in some other way? Sure. I think that if anything, if there's ultimately an attribution of this, I think it's going to come through an intelligence channel, through people who know what the truth is, either being discovered, talking about it, disclosing it privately for their own interests. It's somehow, you know, come leaking out in some way. Having, you know, covered this beat for a long, long time, what strikes me is that something this big is very hard to keep a secret for very long, unless very few people know about it. This big, of course, being the geopolitical ramifications of blowing up these pipelines. But the event itself, as we've been saying, you could probably accomplish with a fairly small number of people. And if it's the case that, you know, the United States or the British or the Ukrainians or the Russians or whoever did this with a small group of people, I think that makes it more likely that it could stay secret for some time. I think you also have to ask the question of whether there's a motive into who did it. I mean, look, if it's an allied government that did it, the allies are going to want to keep that pretty quiet.
I gotta say, though, there aren't that many billion-dollar explosions that go unattributed. You know, one thing the FBI and their sister organizations are really good at is when something goes boom, tracing every bit of residue, explosive, shrapnel back to its original purchase location and figuring out who put the device together. Is it that this one's at the bottom of the ocean that makes that difficult? Or is there some other quality that's inhibiting this from a forensic point of view?
That's a really good question. One thing I would point out, and you're right about, you know, the FBI's ability to, you know, kind of conduct extraordinary and, you know, detailed forensic investigation. To my knowledge, I mean, the FBI is not a party to this investigation. This is not an American asset that was blown up. The American government, the U.S. government, has been a little bit in a passive position on this in, you know, receiving information from investigators in Germany, Denmark. I think Sweden has looked at this as well. So I can't speak to the quality of their investigative agencies. But what I can say is when we spoke to people about what's been recovered from the scene, it was both, I think, you know, fairly voluminous in the sense of, you know, they have debris, they have explosive residue, they've gone down there with cameras, they've got a lot of forensic data. It's just not conclusive. It shows that somebody put a bomb there, but it doesn't tell you exactly who. I didn't get the sense that there was some kind of forensic hurdle that they just couldn't get over, in the sense of like, well, if we really analyze the explosive residue, like, could we trace it back to a certain batch of explosives, and could we trace that batch to a certain source and to a certain route and eventually tie it back to the country? You know, that may be going on. I didn't get that sense. It felt more like the investigators were stumped. And what's also really interesting, and this points to a kind of a broader point that a number of people really made them nervous, is it doesn't appear that there's any kind of, you know, sonar or other kind of marine-based surveillance that gets you to the question of, okay, what ship or what submarine was in the area when this happened. In fact, there's actually been some reporting, notably by Wired, that public source information shows that there were ships in the area at the time of the explosion that turned off their navigational transponders, which essentially made them impossible to track. It's apparently quite easy to do that. So I point that out just to say that, you know, we might assume that, like, well, this is a hugely heavily trafficked area. There must be all kinds of underwater surveillance and other forms of surveillance. Well, I guess not. And it appears that it's actually not all that hard for a ship or a submersible to get in and blow up a cable or blow up a pipeline. And a number of officials we talked to said this is a real cause for concern, because this attack demonstrates just how terribly vulnerable all kinds of undersea infrastructure actually is to sabotage. And apparently not only just vulnerable to sabotage, but sabotage with impunity if it's easy to get in and get out without anybody knowing who did it.
On that cheerful note, Shane Harris, we will be following your continued efforts to get to the bottom of this. Keep us posted as you go.
Okay, will do. Thanks, Ben. Thanks for having me.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is Noam Osband of Goat Rodeo. Look, folks, I know that some of you are holding back on becoming material supporters of Lawfare because you hear the word material support and you think of the criminal statute that prohibits material support for terrorism. And you think, no, I'm going to get charged with material support if I go to patreon.com/lawfare and become a material supporter of Lawfare. But no, the material support statute does not cover national security websites. It covers terrorist groups. We have been designated a national security website since 2010. It is legal to be a material supporter of Lawfare, and that's why you're going to do it right now. The Lawfare Podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.